Well, good morning, Tucson. You're listening to Jump In Tucson, a brand new show. 5 days a week, we get to listen to folks that are really the truly community leaders, and they jump in every day to get the job done. And we have one of those individuals here today, Scott Marchand. Good morning, Scott.
How you doing, Tom?
So, Scott, being the CEO of two museums has got to be a pretty exciting job, a busy job. So what we'd like to do is kind of start out today a little bit about who Scott is and some of the background, and then, of course, how you ended up becoming the CEO of PM Air and Space and Titan Missile Museum.
Right, sure, Tom. Thanks. Well, I've been in the community now for 22 years and originally born and raised in Western Canada, lived in various places around the world after completing university in the early 90s. Did my MPhil at St. Andrews in Scotland in art history and museum studies. And ages ago, I was looking around for fresh opportunities, and there was an ad for junior curator down here ages ago. I applied, got lucky, the rest is history. So I've been here ever since, and Tucson's become my home.
And both museums have grown tremendously under your leadership.
Thank you. Yes, I would like to say they have, but it's also, you know, a big collaborative effort between, you know, community stakeholders, our board of trustees, leadership there, and our critical donors that really contribute economically to making things happen for us.
Yes, I had the opportunity to work with Scott in two capacities, I guess, when you were in charge of the collections. Mm-hmm. And certainly the, I guess, master curator of all. Yeah. And I was over at Old Tucson, and PM Air and Space and Titan Missile were part of what they called the lease property. So they have been partners with Pima County for many, many years. And I got to know your board of trustees. And
yes,
what a pleasure it was every time I got a chance to meet with Count and the rest of the gang and yep, Mr. Mars. And
yep,
I mean, you may know that name, Mars. Been a very strong community leader, especially when it comes to aviation museums. And
yep,
a wonderful board, local community leaders, some of the names you would recognize for sure. But what a close relationship you have with the Board of Trustees.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they're vital to achieving everything we do.
And, you know, it's not only their creativity, but is their ability to have vision to grow the collection from basically zero,
mm-hmm,
when it started out as vacant desert land. Can you tell us a little bit of the history?
Yeah, so our collection was formed across the street from us at the what's now called the 309th AMARG facility, Aerospace Maintenance Regeneration Group. Back in the 1950s, they were the Military Aerospace Disposition Center, nicknamed MASDIC, and there was a real diverse population of aircraft in the 40s and 50s as a consequence of World War II in Korea and the dawn of the jet age. So in the 50s and towards the late 50s, there were a lot of, you know, aircraft that had done their time, served their time, and were being designated for reclamation and scrapping. You know, Tucson being a much smaller and less formal community at that time, and that certainly included the military. I don't even think big parts of the facility were really seriously fenced off at the time either.
Oh, okay.
But a lot of the staff over at MASDIC had been pulling one or two aircraft from the hundreds that they were scrapping and were parking them along Gulf Links Road on the north side of the facility, and that sort of became nicknamed Celebrity Row. In the early 60s, there was close to 50 aircraft of different types and significance parked along there. And an inspector general team from the Pentagon came out to visit the facility and toured around and said, you know, gentlemen, what's up with these airplanes? They're supposed to be scrapped. And they said, well, it seems really shame. And they had a sense of history even then, even though aviation, you know, at that point was barely, you know, 50, 60 years since the Wright brothers. So what sprang from that is the commander of the time and several other community leaders, Morrissey Dahl, the Grossettas and other people in the community, said, look, if we can find some way to get these aircraft off the facility, create an air park, you know, are you guys on board with it? And the Pentagon guys and the Air Force said, yeah, sure, we can play along with that. Little did they know it was going to take us about 14 years to get our act together. But in 1966, we formally chartered, and then we purchased the perpetual land use patent from the Bureau of Land Management, which became administered by Pima County, which is where the least attractions come in. So as long as we are forming the function of an aerospace heritage organization, we have a perpetual right to do that on the property. So we're getting now... God, close to 60 years from our paperwork anniversary, but coming up on our 50th anniversary of opening for business. So we opened in May of 1976, just a month before the bicentennial, as part of the bicentennial celebrations that were widespread across the nation at the time. And we opened with our 50 aircraft from Celebrity Row, and we've been on the grow ever since. We're closing in on probably 500 aircraft now.
And you started off with one hangar, and how many hangars do you have now?
Well, we started off with no hangars, Tom.
Oh,
we had a lot
that?
Of dirt.
All
and we
outside.
Had a, yeah,
okay.
We had a little Airstream trailer, and then not long after that, the base engineers brought over an old barracks building, which was the first administration building. They were busy turning those all into toothpicks in the 70s. And after that, we just continued to grow, and every couple of years we've been able to expand some of our operations to enhance visitor experience and preserve and present more of our collection.
So it's both an indoor and an outdoor facility. Mm-hmm. And what's the average stay time when somebody comes in and really wants to see everything out there?
Oh, well, if you really want to come in and see everything in any depth and detail, usually they do a 2-day pass.
That's great. Oh, yep. That's fantastic.
But if you're just window shopping, it's 3 or 4 hours.
Right. And you also have a tram for those that have a little difficulty walking outside.
Yes, we do. Yep.
And that's daily?
Weather dependent,
okay.
And condition of the equipment. Every now and then we have things that are beyond our control and we're not able to offer them. But generally, yes, we try to make several runs available on a daily basis.
You know, and I didn't quite know the backstory completely. Years ago, we had the opportunity, Pima County as well as Channel 13, to do a television special, 30-minute, on Pima Air, the history of Pima Air and Space. And I learned some things today that weren't in that TV special. But
you're talking to the wrong people, Tom.
Yeah, absolutely. I got to talk to the CEO and the guy that curates everything out there. And it's really a great opportunity to have you, Scott. And we are going to be here for another 40 minutes or so. So stay tuned, everyone. This is Tucson, and we're jumping in with Scott Marchand, CEO of Pima Air and Space and Titan Missile Museum. Well, we're back here at Jump In Tucson. We have a new show every weekday, Monday through Friday, and I'm here normally on Thursdays talking to some of our very unique and exciting attractions in Southern Arizona. And today, we have Scott Marchand, who is the CEO from both Pima Air and Space and Titan Missile Museum. Now, there is a parent company, right, Scott, called the Arizona Aviation Foundation?
Arizona Aerospace Foundation, but that's just our... that's our tax identity. That's sort of the umbrella. So, you know, we do business as the Pima Air and Space Museum and the Titan Missile Museum. So that's really just administrative for our nonprofit status.
Well, the excitement is to go to the museums. Absolutely. And we want to talk a little bit about the Titan Missile Museum, because that also has a unique historical fact of how it began.
Yeah, so the Titan Missile Museum is one of these unique global destinations that is special to the Southern Arizona region. So the Titan Missile Museum is a fully preserved Titan II ICBM missile launch complex. The Titan II missile system was part of the nuclear triad and part of the deterrence, nuclear deterrence component that the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. military operated from the end of the start of the Cold War in 1948 and really until the present day. The Titan was really meant to be the big stick nuclear deterrent to aggression from Russia in the 1960s. So these missiles were the first system that was capable of delivering an atomic warhead anywhere in the world in under 30 minutes with a 3-minute launch capability. Previous to this, you know, the Titan ones and some of the other missile systems were a little less stable, a little harder to manage, and they could take up to 20 minutes to launch from the go. And there was a recognition that that probably placed us at peril of a first strike. So our nation's nuclear deterrence doctrine has always been retaliatory, not offensive. So our posturing was always being able to retaliate to any first strike. So the Titan II enabled a launch in under 3 minutes from initial alert, which doctrinally we felt was a sufficient deterrent to Russian activity. There were three missile wings of Titans of 18 missiles each across the country in Arkansas, up in the Midwest. I always forget where it is. And in the Tucson region, which is the 390 Strategic Missile Wing based out of Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. So there were 18 silos active from 1962 until 1986 in the region. In 1984, the Air Force approached our organization with the intent to preserve one of these silos as a tourist attraction. And working with the Air Force, Pima County, and other critical players in the community, we were able to identify the silo down at Green Valley for preservation. So when the Air Force was decommissioning all the other wings, they were very careful to do the essential decommissioning, but leave it intact and sort of frozen in time as this testament to Cold War tensions and how the missile community lived and worked and operated down there. So when you do come in down, if you haven't visited, it really is, you're stepping back in time to 1984. And you can really imagine the last crew just leaving their alert and leaving it as is. The living quarters are intact. The habitat ring is intact. Command center, you know, the silo, everything is as intended for use. So it's a really sort of gripping and chilling insight into that Cold War period that many of us grew up with. So it took a few years to assemble everything necessary, do the site safety and cleanup and handover. So we opened for business in 1986. It was a very modest facility at the time. To leftover construction trailers from the decommissioning were put together and used as the visitor center there. In 2002, we constructed a 15,000 square foot visitor center, research mm-hmm. center, and archive, which is where we run our tours out of now. And again, like all of our other operations, we're in business every day of the year except Christmas and Thanksgiving. Tours are now scheduled and available in advance online, so I'd strongly encourage you, especially busy times of the year, if you're interested in going, go online to the website, titanmissilemuseum.org, and click on buy your tickets, and you can schedule your time at your leisure. You can always take the chance of a walk-up, but you're subject to availability.
Yeah, I think that's one of the, that's certainly the good things that came out of COVID was the technology of advanced tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely, I would highly encourage what Scott mentioned about making sure you get those tickets in advance, especially the Titan Missile Museum, because it has a finite number of people that can go through every day. Now, I recall my first visit, you had actually two people that were stationed there. And Yvonne was one, and there was another fellow, Chuck, I think it was his name, or sat at the control panel, can't remember, you know, he now working at the Neon Sign Museum.
Yeah.
They actually took you through a launch sequence. So that was pretty exciting and scary at the same time.
Oh yeah, no, that's still part of the experience. You know, we got to remember we're getting 40 years on since
yes.
the retirement of that, and you know, the missileers are actually thinning out.
Yes,
I know the 390th Strategic Missile Wing Association. They had their final reunion last year, so they're now, you know, they're getting in their late 70s and
sure.
early 80s, and time catches up with all of us, and that certainly happened with these people. But it is a chilling insight, and I think, you know, with the tensions in the world right now, I think people are relating to it a little more. directly. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, it's a doomsday weapon, right?
Yes.
I mean, it serves no other purpose than to annihilate cities. Just for sort of rough comparative purpose, the TNT equivalent in the warhead deployed by the Titan II is more than all of the conventional bombs dropped by the United States in World War II in one blow.
Wow.
Imagine that going off over your head.
Yes. We mentioned something about a TV special that we did with Titan. We actually did one on PMAIR and Space that covered Titan, and then we did another one just on Titan. So I would encourage you all to go to YouTube and just put in Titan 30-minute TV special or PMAIR and Space 30-minute TV special. And there's a lot of interviews from the folks that were behind the scenes that put the Titan and PMAIR and Space together. And it is even more chilling after you get done with that, because back in the day, we had, I think it was called Duck. You know, if a
duck and cover.
If a nuclear explosion took place, you were instructed to get under the desk and duck and cover. Obviously, clearly, we learned a lot more about what happens during a nuclear explosion since then. And you know what? We don't want to ever experience one of those for sure. The educational side is quite amazing, and you have a very unique program for school kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so part of our mission and part of our contribution to the residents of Pima County is that you know, all school groups, K through 12, plus community service groups, say Boys and Girls Club, mm-hmm. or Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, that type of thing.
Right.
You know, they're eligible for free admission. So the information on those programs is on our website. But they are regulated. You know, at Titan Missile Museum in particular, we do those tours before opening.
Right.
There's usually one available today. So it's high demand. So if you're interested in going, make arrangements through the website. At the PMAIR and Space Museum, it's a little more flexible, but we do limit the number of school groups that are on site at any one given time. We still have to balance that accessibility with our need to generate revenue from our visitors and accommodate everybody who's interested.
Well, I applaud you and your Board of Trustees for maintaining that program, because I know that's a big thrill.
Mm-hmm.
When my kids were little,
yep,
hard to believe they were little. It was so many years ago, but we moved here in 1997. They were, you know, 7 and 8 years old, and they visited PMAIR and Space and really enjoyed, you know. One time I think you were doing overnight, kind of sleep in at Titan. Is that still around? Or so that was just an old program from the past.
Yep.
But the fact that you can bring a school group and be there before the visitors coming, and so I would imagine that's a very unique experience for these school kids.
Yeah, it definitely is. It's a very new, unique window into how we used to live.
Yeah, and I don't know how much they teach the kids about world history or anymore regarding those tense years in the 50s and 60s regarding nuclear weapons. So it's really good. I think it's just good information to understand that, because deterrence is something you hear a lot now,
mm-hmm.
and some of the you know, the bad players or that are out there. That's a new word to them, I think, you know. So, but we never want to get down to, but it's been pretty serious discussion over the last 2 years. Now, a lot of times when you go out there to PMAIR and Space Museum, there are some former military pilots and I guess we call them volunteers or docents, and are the tours actually are self-guided tours, correct, now with the new system that you have?
Yeah, we can touch on that in the next segment, Tom.
Okay, let's do that, because we're going to have a little bit more time coming up. So you're listening to Jump In Tucson with Scott Martian, CEO of PMAIR and Space and Titan Missile Museum, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. Well, we're back, and this is Jump In Tucson, and we're here with a special guest, Scott Marchon, CEO of two wonderful museums here in town, and we're talking about PMAIR and Space and Titan Missile. The last segment, Scott, we were just starting to talk a little bit about when you go out and you visit these museums, the experience. And so I think it would be important, while it's hard on radio to do a virtual tour, I think it would be interesting to hear from you. What do you actually experience when you go out to PMAIR in space and to Titan missile?
Yeah. Well, so the Titan missile, will start with there because it's a pretty compact, narrowly focused experience. It's a 45-minute to 90-minute experience, led primarily with the underground guided tour that takes you to the briefing room, down to the underground silo complex, out to view the missile in the silo, and then you have the opportunity to self-guide around the top side and view the exhibits and artifacts that we have up there. We've introduced in the last year or so some audio tours that are self-guiding, that are a supplement to the other materials that we provide. So, you know, your time budget down at Titan is, you know, allow 90 minutes from start to finish if you really want to experience everything. So all the information on how to book your tour and what's involved is available on the website, and other information about other programs and resources are there too. So like most businesses, most of our, you know, general outreach on how to plan your visit and what you're going to experience, what to prepare for, is all contained on the website. So that's your best source of information. The telephone is last century. So, you know, go to the website or follow on Facebook or Instagram. There's always updates on what's happening through social media.
So I recall back when I first went through PMAIR in space, there was a mostly emphasis on the military aircraft, but that's changed quite a bit since then.
Well, to be fair, Tom, you know, there was never... The original emphasis was never military aircraft, right?
Okay.
So that was part of the foundational collection. But, you know, when I've gone back and read through early minutes and how they were establishing and the sort of corporate philosophy of the organization, even back in the 60s and up to opening day, it was meant to be a big tent. It was a broad air and space technology history museum. I mean, if like the Hard Rock Cafe, if it flies, it fits, right? I mean, there's room for all of it. And they made very concerted efforts to collect and represent those type of things. You know, we are obviously very deeply representative of military aviation. But if you look at it sort of statistically, you know, most of the dynamic growth, development, and evolution in aviation since 1903 has been driven by warfare and military Yes. applications, right? Most of the civilian and commercial spin-off aircraft have been a consequence of military aviation development. So it's completely logical and natural that we have a high representation of military aircraft because they have been the growth stimulator for aerospace.
Right.
Now, it's also helped that we're right across the street from the largest facility for the storage and regeneration of aircraft on the planet. So, and always have been. So we're kind of the spiritual, you know, we're the stepson or the grandchild of AMARC and those military components. And they've been, you know, very important partners of ours over the year. We continue to have excellent relationships, and they're really key to growing and developing our collection. Our campus site is about 80 acres of publicly developed display area, and we've got about 300,000 square feet of indoor display space in a cluster of about five different hangars with different themes. We've got a terrific lunch service restaurant. We've got a playground. You know, part of our emphasis, certainly under my leadership, is that we need to be accommodating and interesting and receptive to everybody who wants to come. I mean, I think a lot of your formative experience, Tom, was back in the 90s when, unfortunately, we were a little sort of heavily skewed by our leadership and our volunteer corps to lean
Sure.
towards sort of favoritism in the military. And we saw, you know, significant declines in visitorship. I mean, we were seeing steep declines even before 9/11. And afterwards, you know, it's been long uphill climb, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years to really kind of broaden our reach and be more receptive. You know, and now when I look out my office window and walk around and look at, you see, you know, 20 years ago was a lot of, you know, old dudes that looked like you and me kicking around. And now it's multi-generational families, you know, still with the old dudes, you know, driving the visit, but they're bringing along, you know, their wives, their daughters, their grandchildren. We see a lot of mom groups out. There's, we've made a real effort to be clear that there's a lot of history and there's a lot of emphasis and there's a lot of things for everybody, you know. So, you know, I consistently get feedback from, you know, from visitors that, hey, you know, I got dragged out here by so-and-so and I've got these other museums and, you know, you guys were fantastic because it's really, they really enjoyed, you know, the different perspective and more than just this narrow focused agenda. So,
well, Tucson really needs more family attractions. So you've gone in the right direction.
Oh, yeah, and we do several events every year. We have our Halloween Night of Fright. We do our paper airplane fly-off. We have night wings. We have different, you know, scientific and social themes. Last year, during some of the summer programs, we had community animal rescue groups come out and represent what they're up to. So, you know, we're a great place to bring the community together because we have the space, we have the capacity, and you know, we have the desire to help make our community a better place for everybody.
Now, I've brought several kinds of groups out to your museum over the years, and some of them been adults, mm-hmm. and one of the things that when they get done with their tours, they say, well, I need to come back with my son or my daughter or my granddaughter.
Yeah.
And I think that's a wonderful shift.
Oh, sure.
As you mentioned, because when my first visits, and certainly in the 90s, you know, well, I didn't have as much gray hair as I have right now. It was pretty people 45 up, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, very cognizant of the military and how aviation has grown. But then the variety of aircrafts that you mentioned early on, the collection now, it's up to, again, what was that number?
We're getting close to 500 aircraft now.
Wow. And, you know, used to have a lot of planes parked along the side of your property. Mm-hmm. And over the years, because if you expanded your restoration area, let's talk a little bit about what's happened since the big facility was built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the facility improvements have just allowed us to enjoy a greater capacity just in terms of not only the numbers of aircraft, but just the volumetric size of them.
Yes. Like
we're now capable of safely and efficiently painting something like a 747, which 10 years ago certainly wasn't the case without a pretty significant struggle. We were fortunate to have a donor provide the funding to put a large cantilevered roof structure over our outdoor apron and wash rack, which, you know, if you're a local here, you know, from probably May through September, conditions outside are not very comfortable to be working in. And, you know, certainly not when you're working with certain types of materials that are sensitive to heat and temperature. It limits your capacity. So now we have fewer limitations in that context. We have made great strides in developing the collection across sort of all eras and all types. You know, recently we've been able to enhance our NASA aircraft collection. We brought into the collection an aircraft, a Boeing 747 SP, which was the SOFIA program. That's Stratospheric Observation for Infrared Astronomy. Not so easy for me to say, Tom. But this is also a program that had its innovation in Tucson at the U of A in the 1960s. And there's been several platforms that have evolved over the year to conduct infrared astronomy. And so, you know, bringing SOFIA here after the end of its mission was a good spiritual fit and also a good thematic fit for us, and it's proven to be really popular. It's got a global audience. So, you know, all these science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics type of things are one of the big sort of emphasis outside of our historic preservation is encouraging people to look at the aerospace industry as a career field, an academic field. Tucson has always had a very strong aerospace connection. You know, Hughes Missile Systems, now Raytheon, there's Bombardier, there's, you know, two large military communities here. There's the Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, 355th Fighter Wing, Air Combat Command, Air Material Command. You've got the 162nd Wing of the Air Guard at the airport. If you've been coming in out of there, you've seen all the F-16s. They've got a training mission for NATO. Up the road in Pinal, there's an Army aviation. It's Southern Arizona is so rich in aviation history. What can I say?
So much to know about what's going on at PM Air and Space, right, just right down the street from here. And we'll be back with one final segment with Scott. You're listening to Jump In Tucson. See you in a little bit. Well, welcome back to Jump In Tucson. We're on the air 5 days a week at 9 o'clock. And tomorrow you'll be joined with our host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, who's kind of my boss. He's the one who put this program together. I'm here every Thursday talking with the attractions, and hopefully you're learning a lot more about kind of the ins and outs and, you know, what really makes the facility tick. And we want to make sure that you all know more about the attractions because we like you to come out and visit with them. So this is going to be kind of our dream segment, Scott. PM Air and Space and Titan have grown over many times over, mm-hmm. With new exciting opportunities, new experiences, new airplanes, new tours. But if you had to think about what's going to be going on and something you're allowed to share with the rest of mm-hmm. us, can you tell us about some of those near and far dreams of what's going to happen to these two facilities?
Right. So our near dream is actually coming to fruition, is under construction right now. Several years ago, we reacquired the 77 acres to the east of us that are not part of our BLM allotment. And it came with some challenges on the land there, and it took a few years to hammer out some details, and of course, you know, COVID, Monkey Ranch, and interrupted some fundraising efforts, but we managed to pull it over the hill. And in October, we broke ground on the Tucson Military Vehicle Museum that we're constructing. So that should be opening to the public this November, provided construction stays on track. And that's going to be a pretty unique experience for visitors in the Southwest. I mean, as many aviation museums are scattered around the country, there's very few military vehicle museums that aren't a function of a private collector or, you know, in behind secure facilities of the military. So we're going to be featuring and focusing historic military vehicles from all ages and all eras and all nations, like we've done with the aircraft. On that new museum campus, we're going to be having a riding and driving program there. We've been fortunate with our existing loan partner relationships that we've been able to get significant historic vehicles on loan already from the Marine Corps and the Army, a few from the Air Force here and there. We've had some donated. We're doing a little bit of shopping, so it's going to be pretty spectacular. You know, it's one of these things that you got to remember. You know, aviation. I mean, you might wonder, well, what's it's kind of a thematic departure, but in reality, it isn't, because aviation since 1914 has really evolved as a logistical and tactical and strategic support for the military mission on the ground. A lot of commercial aerospace was developed to resupply military ventures, certainly came in very punctuated leaps from the First World War to the Second World War to the Vietnam era to the modern era. So all of these things are tightly interlinked and interwoven. So, you know, having an opportunity to expand our mission, celebrate a little bit more about the experiences and the service and sacrifice of our military community, both here and abroad, we thought was real important to do. There's always been an interest in having a more experiential and hands-on component to our mission. And that's been hard to do with aircraft without an airfield and without the resources to fly and operate. So we hope we can sort of tap into that a little bit more by giving people an opportunity to see some of these unique military vehicles operating, and even take the opportunity to, you know, get behind the wheel or just you know, ride in one of them for fun.
Now, will that be included as part of the Premier and Space package?
Oh, hell no, Tom. That's going to be a completely separate ticket and experience on a separate campus. And,
so we have to remember that there are costs associated, and but you're still very affordable.
Oh, yes, we are, Tom. Yes. Yeah, so what people need to remember, too, is, you know, we're an entirely self-supporting enterprise.
Yes.
We're as entrepreneurial as any other small business in town. We, you know, we benefit from our relationship with the county and the federal government, the Bureau of Land Management, but they're stewards of the land we're on, but every aspect of our operations, every building that goes up, every bill that gets paid, every staff person that gets hired, that all comes from revenues that we generated, you know. The vast majority of our budget that we generate from the external tourist community gets spent in the Tucson economy, right?
So I would presume you'll have a three museum kind of ticket.
I don't know about that far. It's okay. A little, yeah. I mean, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be soft. We'll grow and respond to needs. I mean, there'll definitely be some combination tickets. Titan's really hard to combine because of the scheduling and the limited capacity. It's really impossible to sort of couple those experiences, you know, not only logistically, but geographically, but with the Military Vehicle Museum and the Air Museum being on the same campus, same driveway, it's going to be, there'll be the opportunity to park hop or do multi-day visits.
So beyond that, you had some other dreams you want to share.
Yeah, so we're looking, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the aviation and aerospace history preservation is a big component of what we do. We're, you know, still looking at another hangar and display facility expansion, which, you know, if all things goes well, that might come into reality in the next couple of years. We really do need to get some important stuff inside. One thing we'd really like to be able to do is to put Sophia inside our 747 so we can make it a daily interpretive opportunity. So, you know, with the airplane inside, you know, we can rig it so people can get in and out of it really easily. You know, managing aircraft outdoors for public access is near impossible.
Yes.
You know, and a lot of the aircraft too, when we get them, you have to remember a lot of these are at the end of their economic life, and we don't get them in the best condition. A lot of times they've been completely salvaged inside. They're a big tube that looks like an airplane, right? They become, you know, airplane shaped trailers, right?
Sometimes they come without an engine.
Oh yeah.
And you have to go and find the engine somewhere.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So we preserve them as best we can in the condition we receive them. So, but some things are more accessible than others, and it would be really nice to, you know, talk more about the NASA, the U of A mission, and all these things that have spun out of Tucson and Southern Arizona.
I have to say, my old boss, Mr. Huckleberry, would love to hear that your association with the U of A and NASA. Mm-hmm. Come to life much greater than what it is right now.
Yeah. No, us too. I mean, we're, you know, we're still too much of a well kept secret, Tom. It's
well, hopefully, we're going to be helping here to introduce you to some new potential visitors. You're listening to Tucson Jump In, and we're here almost every Thursday, along with the rest of the gang, Monday through Friday. So, make sure you tune in and listen to Dr. Ackerley, and also make sure you go out and visit Premier Air and Space and Titan Missile and all the other attractions that we have here in Southern Arizona. We'll see you next Thursday. Have a good day.